May it please the court, my name is Jared Walker, appearing on behalf of plaintiff appellant Charlene Hoth in this appeal of the district court's order denying attorney's fees to my client under the Equal Access to Justice Act.
Please, court, would you pull the microphone up a little closer? I'm sorry. That's good. Thank you.
If I may, your honors, I will try to reserve 90 seconds of my time, please. The district court erred in this case both legally and factually in denying plaintiff's fee petition after the court's remand order. Factually, the district court erred because its future order is based on a mistaken belief that the claimant, Ms. Hoth, was represented by an attorney at the ALJ hearing.
The record's a little bit to be confusing. I take it there was an attorney at the beginning who made an appearance, but then somebody from his office who was not an attorney was there was Ms. Hoth. And other points during the proceedings, is that right?
Well, I'm not sure that attorney ever made any appearance.
Is there a statement at the beginning, do you have all the evidence that you want or something like that? And I thought the attorney at that point said he was quite wrong.
That was the non-attorney representative.
The non-attorney representative.
At the hearing. And on that point, Your Honor, I think it's important to note that the commissioner's final decision adopted the ALJ decision, which on the first page, that's page 18 of Appellant's excerpts, it states plainly the claimant was represented by a non-attorney named Michael Paul.
Okay, well, that leads to the question that I really wanted to ask you, which is, does it make a difference? Let's assume that the ALJ, in this case, doesn't fulfill the duty to supplement the record. Does it make a difference that the applicant was represented or unrepresented at the hearing? Isn't the ALJ's duty independent of the counsel?
I think it does make a difference in the sense that if the claimant was represented by a non-attorney under the McLeod case, I believe, 2011 decision from this court, that implicated a heightened duty to develop the record on behalf of the ALJ. And that heightened duty in this court's holding in McLeod, I believe, stated that the ALJ needed to be, quote, especially diligent in developing the record. Matched up against.
The question, though, does that make a difference in this case? In other words, there is a duty, a general duty, to develop the record, right, to ensure that the record is developed now. As you said, if the applicant is not represented by an attorney, then maybe that becomes a more heightened duty. But the duty is still there regardless. So the question is, what do you say? Maybe it'll meet the more heightened threshold, but not the regular threshold of developing the record.
Well, our position is that. Well, I think in this case, under the Equal Access to Justice Act, whatever standard the ALJ was under to develop the record, the failure to do so here was so egregious that under any standard, attorney's fees under EJIA should have been awarded, meaning that the government's
this answer to Judge Hurwitz's question, no, it doesn't make a difference in this case.
I think in this case, it doesn't make a difference.
So, if your client had been represented by counsel at this proceeding before the ALJ and exactly the same things ensued, would the ALJ have had an obligation to develop the record?
Absolutely. And if,
so, in this case, I take it your view is it makes no difference whether she was represented or not.
Our view is that it makes no difference simply because the error in developing the record was so improper. By the ALJ such that there's no basis to say the government's position at the agency level met the standard of simple.
So here's just another question that's a little bit different from your briefs are devoted to the notion that what was substantially unjustified was the ALJ's decision. When this case went from the agency to the district court, the government opposed the motion to remand, correct? Are you claiming that the government's position in the district court was substantially unjustified?
Absolutely. And as far as the district court's error in denying attorney's fees under EJIA, I think that issue, whether the government was was substantially justified in defending this case in court, that wasn't addressed. And so I think as...
Did you argue it?
Yes.
Did you argue that to the district judge?
Yes, it was the fourth argument we went forward.
And the district judge never reached it because she, the magistrate judge, found it. In this case, the ALJ wasn't in effect. Substantially unjustified, or substantially justified in his position.
So, if I'm understanding the question, Your Honor.
I want to know why the district court never reached that argument.
Of whether the
government was substantially unjustified in its position in the district court.
We don't have an explanation for that.
Well, what's your explanation? And as to why, I gather your position is that the government's position, litigation position, was not substantially justified.
Correct.
And what's the reason for that? In other words, I think that the problem is suppose, you know, it was after a hearing on your motion overall, but how much fees you're entitled, it depends in part on whether or not you were, your position was justified in the district court as well as before the commissioner.
I think, Your Honor, that the answer to that question is whether we're entitled to fees. My client depends on whether the government had substantial justification.
How much you're entitled to, but how much you're entitled to?
No, Your Honor. I believe this court's holding in Meyer versus Colvin explained that what matters is the result.
Well, this is what I'm getting at. Suppose we agree with you that the government, position, administratively was not substantially justified because the ALJ failed to develop the record right now, and there's nothing more in the district court to make the government's position not substantially justified. Now, should you get fees for the time you spent in district court?
Yes. Well, for all of our efforts in obtaining the result of...
And it wouldn't matter, I take it, if the government... I guess my question, could the government be substantially justified in defending the ALJ's order if the ALJ wasn't substantially justified in entering it?
I think this court has said that would be the unusual case, and particularly here, where the failure to develop is egregious, meaning on the record at the hearing, the ALJ told this claimant that 3 years of relevant treatment records that the ALJ didn't have, the claimant testified she thought the ALJ did have, the ALJ instructed the claimant those records didn't matter, that let's not worry about those missing records. That sort of procedural error, I think, it's tough to understand why the government would be so vigorous in going forward to defend that procedural error rather than just accept a remand to go and fix the problem and try to get it right.
If they accepted a remand, you'd still be claiming fees from the administrative proceeding, wouldn't you?
Well, our fees would be substantially reduced. We would have to brief the issue and as well.
I see you claim, although the government's action as an advocate in the district level and also the ALJ's conduct in failing to
Yes, Your Honor, and as far as the district court's legal error, the major legal error here is that the district court was required to consider both the substantial justification of the agency at the agency level and then also in defending in court, and the district court's error or district court's legal order doesn't address at all whether the government was substantially justified in defending in court. That's a legal error.
You asked to save some time for a
reason, sir. Thank you.
To remind you. We'll hear from the government.
Please, the court, to hear Bowen from the Nicole Colvin. I think she's been planted.
I know, but this stuff moves so fast that we're stuck with the names you put on the briefs.
Okay.
we will make sure that when the disposition is made in this case, we have the correct name of the commissioner.
It's the acting commissioner is now Nancy Day Perry, now effective January 20th, but I tell you. As far as the government's position is that the district court was within its discretion in denying attorney fees and legal access to Justice Adams.
evidence. Can we look at this case backwards for a second?
Sure.
Let's assume, just for purposes of discussion, it wasn't egregious on behalf of the ALJ. The ALJ just made a mistake, and we wouldn't ordinarily order fees because of what the ALJ did. I'm not saying that's where we end up, but it's still that. I'm concerned in this case that once the error became obvious, that the government nonetheless puts cost through a district court proceeding rather than simply saying, oh, you're right, let's remand it and let's get this error fixed. So was your litigation position substantially unjustified in this case? By you personally, but obviously.
Well, I wrote the brief, so it wasn't the personal regulation. The administrative position, the position that the agency took as to the question of disability was reasonable, and that is entwined with the litigation position. If the ALJ had a reasonable basis to consider the record complete or sufficient to make a disability determination, then if he was reasonable in making those assumptions based on the representations of the claimant's attorneys, then it follows that it was reasonable to defend that decision as based on an adequate record.
Well, but I guess I have two questions about that. One, it's rather clear that the ALJ knew that there were several years of records, one of which went, I think, right up to the claim onset date, maybe past it, that weren't there. Isn't that a red flag for the ALJ? Even if, unless you're an attorney, said the record was complete, but whether it was an attorney or attorney's representative, to me, doesn't make a big difference. Even in light of that representation, is that what ALJs are supposed to do?
They do have a duty to develop the record when it's ambiguous, or the ALJ makes a finding that it's inadequate to allow for proper evaluation of the evidence. The ALJ didn't make such a finding, and arguably the record is not so ambiguous, given that plaintiff's representatives consistently said that it was complete, never alleged that there was any material probative evidence missing from the record. The claimant herself testified through counsel at the hearing that the record was complete and that they had everything. So in those circumstances, it was reasonable to think that the ALJ is.
How do we match that up with the ALJ saying on the record, I know that there's an absence of these records, but I'll proceed without them.
Well, that goes to.
At that point, the ALJ knew that whatever representations that had been made about the completeness of the record weren't entirely accurate.
But he was entitled to rely on the representations of the attorneys.
Is this a real attorney or just another attorney?
I admit there's some ambiguity about that in the record, but it appears from case law outside this case that he has appeared as an attorney for Avi Leibovich, who was consistently noted, even on the day of the hearing, as claimant's representative. Experienced legal counsel, they helped claimant file her application for benefits, they helped prepare for the hearing, and excuse me, yes, that's fine. But other cases have shown him to be an attorney, or at least present himself as an attorney. And definitely in this, in the record of this decision, he appears as both. He appears as an attorney at the hearing, he appears as a non-representative, a non-attorney representative in the ALJ's decision.
The ALJ says, I'm just looking for it. The claimant is represented by Michael Paul, non-attorney representative.
Yes.
At least on this record, the ALJ understood she wasn't representative of counsel. Right?
Yes.
Does that make any difference in the case?
No, there's still a duty to develop the record whether the claimant's represented or not. But that's in tension with the claimant's burden of proof. This was a four-step decision, meaning that at each of the four steps of the disability evaluation, sequential disability evaluation, it was plaintiff's burden of proof to show that she could pass that step. She produced none of the records that supposedly would have helped her in that, as to the period prior to her eligibility for benefits.
So, taking your position is because she lost cost-added benefits in Step 5.
Step 4.
Step 4. And it didn't really matter that she didn't have the records. Is that your position?
No.
So tell me what it is. Would the records have made a difference?
It was the claimant's burden to produce records that would have made a difference.
That's right. I understand. I'm asking a different question. Assume error for a second, because you're not appealing the district court's remand.
That's right. It's been remanded.
Right. So we have to, on this case, we have to assume that there was error in the agency proceeding, correct?
Yes, but not necessarily.
Right. I understand. I'm trying to figure out how important the error was. Would the records that were not admitted have made a difference in the disposition of this case?
Well, the district court thought they might.
And that's the law of this case.
The law?
That's the law of this case. Yes. Because you didn't appeal. Yes. So we have records that might have made a difference, of which the ALJ was aware of their existence. And why doesn't that make the ALJ's position, I think, not supplementing the records substantially enough to justify it?
Because he reasonably relied on the consistent position throughout administrative proceedings that those records were not relevant to the question of disability by the claimant's attorneys.
Well, this is what the district court says, or the magistrate judge of the order denying the AHA fees. The bottom of page 2, top of page 3, to me, this is the key sentence. Although this court concluded that the records concerned treatment during the alleged onset of claimant's disability was a missing records, and were therefore relevant to the ultimate determination of disability, the ALJ reasonably relied on the applicant's attorney to supply the relevant records.
Yes.
Well, that should be the end of the story, then. I mean, in other words, the ALJ can't rely on the applicant's attorney to the exclusion of her own duty.
She has a duty, but the claimant also bears the burden of proof, so there is a tension between that duty and that burden, but it's undisputed that neither claimant nor her attorneys ever bothered to produce or ever alleged that any relevant material records were missing from the record.
Can I go back to the question I asked your opponent at the beginning? On the face of the ALJ's decision, we know the ALJ was aware that the person representing Ms. Hoth was not an attorney.
That's exactly what he thought, based on Michael Paul checking the box saying
it's not already represented. So, does it make a difference? In other words, would the position of the ALJ have been more justified had Mr. Paul been an attorney, or less justified?
I don't think the law comes down on that question.
It seems to me that if somebody is really represented by an experienced attorney, an ALJ might say, well, the attorney knows best, but if the person is represented by a non-attorney, I think the ALJ may be on a more heightened level of scrutiny, perhaps.
But he was represented by attorneys throughout.
That's not what this record shows.
How does it not show that, besides the question of Michael Paul?
At the hearing, we know that the ALJ understood that Ms. Hoth was represented by a non-attorney representative. She may have had an attorney who helped her in this proceedings otherwise, but at the hearing, the person there was Mr. Paul, correct?
Yes.
A non-attorney representative.
Perhaps.
This record, I mean, you say if I look around, maybe he may believe he was a lawyer on other occasions. I can't believe that he really was a lawyer except a non-attorney representative.
Well, he might have done that because she put down on that same form that her main attorney was Avi Leibovich.
It's a Leibovich law firm. On this record before us, we have a non-attorney representing, correct?
That's one way.
That's the only way the ALJ looked at it. That's what the ALJ said.
Yes.
So, in your view, that doesn't make a difference, does it?
No, I don't think so, because it's still the claimant's burden to produce evidence that of her impairments and how they affect her ability to work, and she never did that. For the period.
You're almost taking the position that the duty of the claimant overrides the ALJ's duty to ensure that they're the full and complete record.
Not that overriding.
not a spouse.
So,
no,
there is a your statement is correct. They have to be that duty, but in spite of that, the ALJ still has the duty to ensure that the records are valid, right? And the ALJ knew these 3 years of records were missing. Crucial record right at the outset of the disability.
There's no evidence that they were crucial.
Well, that's probably okay. They don't have the records, right?
Right. But they were never alleged to be crucial, even by claimant or her attorneys.
Well, in fact, they don't drop the obviously or the issue of whether or not there was a disability.
The district court thought they might be. But given the fact
that there's no other basis on which to base the finding that there was a disability, is there?
The ALJ based its finding of non-disability on the record before him, which
right.
went back into 2007 and covered the period for which the claimant was eligible for benefits. Given that, that evidence undisputedly showed that she was not disabled. She was limited functionally, but not disabled. I think there's an argument to be made that it's likely that evidence prior to that period of eligibility wouldn't necessarily show that she was much worse off during the period that she was found to not be disabled. So, I mean, I think there's a question of whether those records are relevant.
We've taken it into overtime. You've responded to Judge's questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, very briefly, on appellant's excerpts at pages 37 to 42, it makes clear that claimant never testified the records work was complete. To the contrary, she testified that she understood that the ALJ had in his possession records from 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. The ALJ excerpts 37 to 42 states, no, I don't have those. And then goes on to say, even though those are relevant to your alleged period of disability, let's not worry about them. So the argument that claimant testified the record was complete is rebutted by the hearing transcript itself.
The only ALJ asked this Mr. Paul whether he needed to put records in.
The ALJ did not ask if Mr. Paul wanted the record left open. What the ALJ did ask at the outset is the record complete? Mr. Paul, in his capacity as a non-attorney representative, remarked, yes. Claimant testified to the contrary, though.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both counsel in this case. The case is submitted.